Today is Friday, May 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What is it like to be part of a COVID-19 vaccine study?
I'm betting that the virus is worse than the vaccine.
Plus, the first typhoon of the season has killed at least one in the Philippines.
The presidential spokesperson, Harry Roque, said that the government is in full force for the storm, even the country is fighting for the COVID-19 pandemic.
And Frozen's Elsa, Anna, and Olaf have been let go. Those stories and more are next. The Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker counts nearly 4.5 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus worldwide, with over 300,000 deaths attributed to it. This comes as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration voiced caution over Abbott Laboratories' widely used ID Now coronavirus test on Thursday, warning that it may be unreliable despite having gotten FDA approval in late March. Reuters' Gloria So has that story.
It delivers results within minutes and is used at the White House. But the FDA said in a statement that while the test can still be used on patients, it could potentially produce inaccurate results. The U.S. regulator added that it was still reviewing data on the test and working with Abbott to find other ways to study it. Abbott has distributed nearly 2 million ID Now tests. And on Wednesday, a separate non-peer-reviewed study by New York University researchers said the ID Now tests could be missing a third to nearly half of all positive cases. And a study conducted by the Cleveland Clinic in April showed that while the test detected the virus in around 85% of cases, that was still lower than some other coronavirus tests. In its statement, the FDA said that while these studies did offer, quote, important information, it should be noted these studies have limitations, including small sample size, potential design biases, or tests that may not have been executed according to the manufacturer's instructions for use. Abbott has also criticized the studies, saying in a statement on Thursday that the number of patients tested in the NYU study was small and that the Cleveland study performed the test incorrectly. Abbott also pointed to other studies showing a much higher accuracy rate for the ID Now tests. One study done by a testing clinic in Detroit said the test was accurate 98% of the time.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. U.S. President Donald Trump will discuss coronavirus vaccine development efforts this afternoon, a day after contradicting a top government scientist's views on how long it will take to come up with a vaccine. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani takes things from here.
Dr. Rick Bright told a House panel there's a lot of optimism about a vaccine coming about in 12 to 18 months. He says that's if everything goes perfectly.
We've never seen everything go perfectly.
And it won't this time.
And I think it's going to take longer than that.
Bright also says the nation has no plan for distributing the vaccine to everyone. The president disagreed with most everything Bright said.
I think we're going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. And I think distribution will take place almost simultaneously.
Bright has said he was fired from leading a top science agency because he pushed the administration to better prepare for the pandemic. The president calls him disgruntled and unhappy. Sagar Magani, Washington.
As the global race to find a vaccine against the coronavirus intensifies, medical researchers are looking for people to participate in clinical trials testing potential vaccines in humans. One such study is taking place at one of America's leading research institutions, Emory University, in Atlanta, Georgia. VOA's Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick spoke to a man who signed up for Emory's clinical trial. Jack Cross is a senior digital writer at The Weather Company. She began by asking Cross via Skype what's involved, what the risks are, and why is he doing it?
I want to get this immunity, so it's possible I will benefit. I'm betting that the virus is worse than the vaccine. And from what I've heard, there haven't been any serious side effects in the initial small group of people that have been tested.
So, Jack, there are three phases to this trial, and you're waiting to hear if they're going to include you in the second phase, where they're going to be testing whether or not the vaccine is actually effective. What are they telling you about the risks involved, and what exactly makes a good candidate?
Yes, it definitely is a risk. They're very clear that they don't know what the risks are, and that's why they're doing these trials. Even after they determine, Emory University determines that there are no risks, it would have to go through FDA approval, and that would be even more rigorous. You know, initially you're screened to check on your medical condition. They take two sets of blood work, other tests that go over your medical history, and then if they determine that you're a good candidate, then they'll give you the vaccine. Then about a month later, they'll give you another shot of it, a booster shot. Then after that, you go back first in a week, then in a couple of weeks, then in a month, then in a couple of months, then in 6 months, and finally a year. First, they want to see how you're doing. And secondly, they want to see whether you're developing antibodies, whether you're developing immunity to the virus. So you aren't being exposed to the virus. They just want to see if your body is getting a reaction to the vaccine.
And what are you learning about how a vaccine trial actually works?
Now, this is fairly new technology. They, and in a way, it's sort of artificial. They use a technique called RNA sequencing. Your body's cells respond by creating a viral protein that mimics the coronavirus. So your body thinks it has coronavirus, and it's hoped you develop antibodies to it. So it's different from a flu shot in that you're not being injected actually with COVID-19. Now, I don't know whether that makes it safer. I'm hoping it does. But the unique thing about this vaccine is that it's faster to develop in only 42 days. But even though that was fast, it still takes a long time to go through these trials. They expect at least a year before they determine whether it works and whether it's safe. They started with one group in Seattle, and then they're doing more trials with another group in Atlanta. And then in addition to that, there's several different age groups. They started with 18 to 55-year-olds. They have better immune systems. And then they're moving on to 56 to 70-year-olds. I have to admit, I'm in that group. And then after that, they'll be moving on to 70-year-olds and older.
Jack, are there moments when you have second thoughts or when you wonder whether or not you're doing the right thing?
Yes, I do. I tried to weigh it, and it seemed to me like the advantages of doing this outweigh the disadvantages. I'm hoping they call me up, and I will be in touch with them to see my check on my status. And I think I'm going to do this.
Jack Cross is a digital writer at The Weather Company, currently participating in a vaccine study at Emory University. He was speaking to VOA's Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick. Coping with the pandemic has been a personal trial for almost everyone in the world. But from a professional point of view, health and hospital workers are facing some of the most difficult challenges. The response against COVID-19 has also meant heroic efforts by many workers behind the scenes as they procure equipment and supplies, as well as organizing personnel. In this part of our ongoing series of interviews with those on the front line, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with nurse Christina Masvidal, a senior director for patient safety and risk management at Jackson Health System in Miami, Florida.
So we are always quite busy, like you just said. But when COVID came into the picture, it was kind of like watching a hurricane that was out in the ocean and you were waiting for it to hit your city. And we were doing as much as we possibly could to prepare and anticipate based on what we heard internationally, which wasn't such great information, right? And you're trusting an outside source. We had to break down every process that we normally anticipate and are trained for, but step it up exponentially, understanding that this virus was very, very lethal.
What did that involve specifically?
So anything associated with corona, from preparing our staff, ensuring that they felt comfortable to take care of these patients, to gathering our protective eye and body gear, to making sure that we had enough rooms that could possibly anticipate the number of patients we would receive during this pandemic.
That meant a lot more equipment too.
Right. We had to make sure we had the ventilators. We had to make sure that we had enough staff trained on those ventilators, that we had enough ICU nurses, and that we could actually reorganize the other staff for elective surgeries and put them in other parts of the hospital to kind of decompress the stress on the staff. So you really felt like I'm just doing the best I possibly can for a storm that I really never was trained to deal with. We dealt with tuberculosis and other infections that come in internationally, but this was impacting different ages, different demographics, and it was having such an impact on the immune system that we did not know our normal practices would even work.
This wasn't just a clinical crisis. It was also a personal crisis for many of your colleagues.
Right. This one was more isolating. We really couldn't go back to our families. We needed to protect our families. And understanding that you are the front line, we're grateful to have our jobs. But again, I believe some staff would actually have hoped that they wouldn't be required to be that frontline healthcare provider.
So it's also your job to attend to the fear and the burnout among the staff.
Absolutely. That was something I also made sure we brought into play. And we created a on-call beeper that literally staff could page in real time to receive therapy if needed. And our teams have been using it as a nurse or any healthcare provider. You just feel this overwhelming grief that everyone's experiencing, all these people that have died, not even having family at their side, and the funerals that are not occurring. And any patient right now who's dying does not have a loved one at their side. So as a nurse, that's an additional stress.
Have you made use of this therapeutic support?
I haven't seen my family in 2 months, so I count on this therapist a lot, to say the least.
I know that personal protective gear, masks, gloves, gowns, etc., have been in short supply at your hospital and elsewhere. How are you coping with that?
We did some sort of repurposing and reusing of protective gear, and we have a daily corona call at 7:30 in the morning. The three facilities that we have will tell you how much PPE is available at each, what are the needs for each. And then if necessary, we share them. And we also communicate with the other hospitals in South Florida to see how they're doing. We're all just doing our best, honestly. But it probably is the most disappointing factor in the U.S. for us who brag and boast about our healthcare and how great our healthcare is. I was completely disappointed by our lack of preparation for this pandemic.
Do you have a sense that the general public really appreciates all that American health workers are undergoing to save lives?
That's a tricky question. I do believe that they sincerely appreciate, but now as we are trying to reopen, I fear that there is a little less respect for what we've been doing and the sacrifices that our teams and staff have been making.
Anything you'd like to add? Maybe something you'd like to say to our African listeners?
Do your best. Good luck and reach out for support from anyone and everywhere. And may God be with you.
Christina Masvidal is the Senior Director of Patient Safety and Risk Management for Jackson Health System in Miami, Florida. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Now, for additional stories and updates on the global pandemic, visit our website, voanews.com. And coming up later in the program.
So I definitely think it's going to happen again. It's just a matter of when. When do we feel safe enough for people to travel? When do we feel safe enough to sit down in a dark space and have a shared experience?
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study that was presented at the American Geophysical Union's recent Ocean Sciences Meeting 2020 projects that between 70 to 90% of Earth's coral reefs will disappear over the next 20 years. The study goes on to suggest that factors like rising sea surface temperatures and acidic waters could destroy nearly all existing coral reef habitats by the end of the 21st century. The study authors also mapped areas of the ocean that they consider suitable for coral restoration efforts over the coming years. Renee Setter from the University of Hawaii, Manoa, who presented the new findings, says that the few sites possible for coral restoration by 2100 include only small parts of Baja California and the Red Sea. She adds that even these locations aren't ideal coral reef locations because of their nearness to rivers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights warns failure to address social and economic inequalities will make it more difficult to contain COVID-19 and will likely lead to more catastrophic pandemics in the future. Lisa Schlein has that story.
As with most things in life, the rich are weathering the coronavirus crisis better than the poor and marginalized. Several months into the pandemic, emerging data show that people on the lowest rungs of society are suffering the worst physical, mental, and economic effects. Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the virus itself does not discriminate, but it has laid bare the huge economic and social inequalities that exist. She says that must be addressed by creating a post-COVID-19 recovery plan that is more inclusive and sustainable.
The majority of the emerging diseases on the last year, not only COVID-19, but if we start thinking on SARS, MERS, Ebola, a lot of different flus, huge flus, are all zoonoses. They are transmitted from animals to human beings and then human being to human being.
Bachelet warns many more crises will arise in the future if problems of inequality continue to be ignored. The High Commissioner also expresses concern about the surge in hate speech, xenophobia, and restrictions on basic freedoms stemming from fears and misinformation about the pandemic. She says national leaders have to speak out against efforts to vilify others for a disease that is not of their doing.
As a former politician, I know how difficult it can be for national leaders and ruling parties to take politics out of the equation. But also as a doctor, I know that this pandemic will not be contained by politics or ideologies or by a purely economic focus. It will be contained by careful, sensitive, science-guided policymaking and by responsible and humane leadership.
Bachelet warns allowing politics or economics to drive the response at the expense of health and human rights will cost lives and do more damage. She says championing the rights of the elite at the expense of those who are less privileged will cause coronavirus to flare up again, and that, she says, will have serious consequences for everyone. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Philippine governor says a typhoon's ferocious wind and rain has left at least one person dead and damaged hundreds of coronavirus isolation facilities and homes, along with rice and cornfields in five hard-hit eastern towns. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Stanley Gahete, based in Quezon City, via Skype, to get the details on the year's first typhoon to hit the country.
Steve, the Philippines braces for another emergency as Typhoon Vongfong now heads towards the eastern parts of the country while confronting the ill effects of the COVID-19. What is something hard is that the Philippines is currently on its summer season, then immediately shift to wet as Typhoon is fast approaching and hurtling the country. Typhoon Vongfong, with local name Ambo, slightly weakens and is now approaching the province of Real Infanta in northern Quezon, in the eastern parts of the Philippines, about 100 kilometers from Metro Manila. Tonight, Typhoon Vongfong will approach the Metro Manila between 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. and is currently moving northwestward of the Philippines at 20 kilometers per hour, with maximum sustained winds of up to 100 kilometers per hour near the center and gustiness of up to 140 kilometers per hour. Metro Manila is currently under signal number 2. Heavy rains are expected until tomorrow, Saturday, over some parts of the Luzon Island. The presidential spokesperson, Harry Roque, said that the government is in full force for the storm, even the country is fighting for the COVID-19 pandemic. The government is still expecting social distancing on prepared evacuation areas in the current affected provinces. According to local governments, they are still using appropriate health protocols, and only 50% of the total number of evacuees in case will be allowed to evacuate on evacuation centers. The Metro Manila, for example, is using different schools, barangay halls, multipurpose halls, covered courts as evacuation centers. But for now, there are still no reported evacuees in Metro Manila. And for information, school facilities will be identified as the last resort isolation facilities for COVID-19. Some provinces can't even control social distancing. For example, in Gumaca, Quezon, one of the provinces in eastern Philippines, recorded 729 evacuated families with 2,604 individuals. 30 out of 59 villages said they already have evacuees, but the local government says that they are still supervising and monitoring since one villages, for example, have less than 10 evacuated families. Meanwhile, the Social Welfare and Development Department has a total stockpile funds of 1.2 billion peso or about $23.6 million, which can be used as disaster response emergencies on affected areas.
Stanley Gahete is a reporter in Quezon City, the Philippines. Turkish authorities have detained four more elected mayors from Turkey's mainly Kurdish-populated east and southeast regions as the government presses ahead with a crackdown on a pro-Kurdish party it accuses of links to Kurdish militants. The mayors from the People's Democratic Party were detained at their homes on Friday, removed from office, and replaced with government-appointed trustees, according to state-run media. The government accuses the party of links to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK. The party denies the accusation. European Union foreign ministers are holding talks Friday to work out what to do if Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu goes ahead with plans to annex the West Bank. The ministers had planned to welcome in his new government with rival-turned partner Benny Gantz and offer their cooperation. But the cabinet swearing-in ceremony has been postponed until Sunday. The 27 EU nations are divided in their positions on Israel, and there appears to be no real appetite to take action, such as sanctions, should Netanyahu move forward. Authorities have reported the first coronavirus case in the crowded camps for Rohingya refugees in southern Bangladesh. More than 1 million refugees from Myanmar are sheltered in the camps. Aid workers have been warning that tackling any outbreak could be a daunting task in the crowded camps. Bangladesh and the UN Refugee Agency said the person who was infected and a second local resident in the district have been isolated. Investigators are working to trace their contacts and quarantine and test others. The Broadway family musical Frozen is closing permanently. Producers made that announcement Thursday. It's the first big casualty of the shutdown in New York's theater industry. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that story.
If you wanted to see popular Disney movie Frozen as a Broadway musical, unfortunately, Elsa and her sister Anna's onstage adventures have been put on ice. On Thursday, Disney announced the show is closing permanently. Months ago, it was the first and biggest production to shut down in New York's theatre industry. Broadway went dark back in March, and the theatre closures have extended to September 6th. Live performances, especially big musicals with their large casts, will face the grave challenge of how to rework shows that respect social distancing on stage between actors and among audiences. They're expected to be among the last events to return. Frozen the musical opened in 2018 and was taking an average of about $1 million a week in ticket sales, according to box office data. The show's executive director, Mary McColl, warned of the impact on the arts sector in a statement, calling on New York's mayor, saying, quote, "Public officials at all levels must think much more boldly about supporting the arts, or our entire economy will be slower to recover." For now, fans will have to be content listening to Oscar-winning song Let It Go in their living rooms.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. Speaking to Reuters News earlier this month, Broadway producer Brian Moreland said that when shows do come back, things would be different.
And we have to adhere to that, right? Everyone has to feel safe. Everyone has to feel supported, from our audience members to our ticket takers to our ushers to the people on stage to the people backstage. Everyone has to feel safe. So I definitely think it's going to happen again. It's just a matter of when. When do we feel safe enough for people to travel? When do we feel safe enough to sit down in a dark space and have a shared experience?
And while Broadway is closed, some are streaming plays online. Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber's YouTube channel, The Show Must Go On, has been showcasing his biggest musicals. This weekend will mark the seventh installment of his series, featuring a 1988 performance of the musical Cats. But if you want to see one of Broadway's longest-running plays, you'll have to do it fast. The YouTube channel will only show the musical for 48 hours internationally, starting at 1800 UTC Friday. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a fantastic Friday and an amazing weekend.